Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Dr. Livingston, I presume. Ravi Zacharias talks about the amazing travels of David Livingston through Africa. Then on to the Battle of Arnhem, quite a regular theme on these shows. The book is called Arnhem Myths and Realities, and the author is Seb Ritchie. He's the chief historian for the Royal Air Force. And then the Poppy Appeal, Veterans for Peace member James Florey, former infantryman, talks about the Poppy Appeal and what he thinks about it and the attitude of the Veterans for Peace in Britain and around the world. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street most of the time. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
David Livingstone was born in Blantyre, Scotland in 1813. He was born into a home where his father used to put him on his knee and read to him stories of great missionary exploits, one particularly Carl Gutzlaff, the Dutch missionary, who doubled up as a medical missionary too. And young David used to look into his father's eyes and say, "You know, Daddy, one day I'm going to be a man like that. I want to be a missionary. I want to be a doctor. I want to serve God." So David Livingstone, in his young life, got on his knees one day and he prayed this prayer. He said, "Send me anywhere. Only go with me. Lay any burden on me, only sustain me. Sever any ties but the ties that bind me to your service and to your heart." And he said, "Through it all, the words of God came to me. Lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the age." He packed his bags and he went off to Africa. And when he took one glimpse of Africa from a distance, he penned in his journal these words: "The haunting specter of the smoke of 1,000 villages in the morning sun has burned within my heart. The haunting specter of the smoke of 1,000 villages in the morning sun has burned within my heart." He married a woman of the famous Moffat family. Mary was her name. Her father had been a great missionary. But David Livingstone's life was one of an explorer, and he would move from place to place, and his only goal was Jesus in the hearts and lives of men and women, thousands of them. Finally, his wife and his young family couldn't keep up with him anymore. Some of his children were dying out of sickness and disease. And he said, "Mary, why don't you take them back home, and I will see you shortly and spend some more time with you. It's too dangerous for us to go on." So he sent his dear wife Mary back home, and letters would take months to exchange, but some of the fondest letters of love and romance were exchanged between David and Mary. And you know when he saw her the next time? Not 5 weeks. Not 5 months, 5 years. As an evangelist, I can't even stay away 5 weeks now. As a matter of fact, it's been a long time since I've stayed away that long, and I don't intend doing it anymore. 5 days is long enough. 5 months, I would never dream of and never want to do. 5 years. I am neither condemning the man nor exalting the man. I'm just telling you what went on in his life. 5 years later, when he set eyes upon his wife, she could not recognize him. Because at one stage in his jungle travels, going to preach, he'd walked into the branch of a tree that had completely blinded him in one eye and marred the other. His face had been burnt under the African sun to a crisp and leather, and his skin not being pigmented for it, it had roasted him to a point that his body really could not take any longer. His face marred and scarred, his eye blinded. At one time he'd been attacked by a lion that had torn one of his shoulders apart. He miraculously escaped. And now she saw her husband hobbling in with a marred face and a disfigured physical countenance. And yet, hours before he arrived, they had buried his father, and David wept because he'd longed to look at his dad and tell him stories firsthand that his father had only told him third hand. Biographical sketches tell us that when David Livingstone walked into every university in the British Isles, students and faculties would rise to a standing ovation. They knew they were standing in the presence of a giant of a man. Finally, he went back to his wife one day and he said, "Honey, the haunting specter of the smoke of 1,000 villages and the morning sun is still burning within my heart. We need to go back." And at one point she decided that he should go, but she couldn't. She had to be with the children. She said, "When they're all old enough, I will join you again, David." And he set off on his lonely journey to preach to the African people who were so much within his heart. Finally, after a long time, Mary joined him. And the day she set foot on African soil, she contracted the disease that they so dreaded she would contract. The very day she set foot, she got that disease. And a few days later, he was burying her. Lowered into the soil of the African earth there. An eyewitness said David Livingstone knelt beside the grave and he was weeping his heart out, and they overheard him praying, "My Jesus, my King, my life, my all, I again consecrate my life to thee. I shall place no value in anything I possess or in anything I may do except in relation to thy kingdom and to thy service." And through it all there came the words of God to my heart. He said, "Lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the age." He picked up his belongings and walked back towards his village, hometown village of Ujiji. When he arrived and went into his little home there, he found out somebody had played a cruel joke on him and stolen his medication that he so needed, because his body was racked with pain, untold pain. He walked in constant agony. And they said in one of the very few times in his life for praying for himself, he got down on his knees and wept, and he said, "God, you promised that you would always be with me. I need that medication if I'm to continue to preach the gospel." And as he prayed, he heard steps. And as the story goes, he saw a pair of feet planted in front of him, and his countenance lifted for the first time in a long while. He was looking in the face of a white man who didn't live in Africa. And he said, "Who are you, sir?" And he says, "Mr. Livingstone, I presume." You get that famous line from there. He looks at him and says, "Mr. Livingstone, I presume." He says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Mr. Livingstone, I'm a press reporter consigned to do a story on your life. I want you to know two things about me. Number one, I'm the biggest swaggering atheist on the face of the earth. Please don't try to convert me. Number two, somebody has sent some medication for you." He says, "Give me the medication, please." And Mr. Henry M. Stanley started to travel with David Livingstone. 4 months later, the biggest swaggering atheist on the face of the earth knelt down on African soil and gave his life to Jesus Christ. One of the best biographies you'll ever read, 2 volumes entitled Livingstone of Africa by Henry M. Stanley. He said, "The power of that Christ life was awesome, and I had to buckle in. I couldn't hold out any longer." Finally, as his body began to shrivel with high temperatures and pain, they used to carry him around from village to village on a stretcher. One day, preaching from a stretcher with his body literally trembling, he finally looked at two of his national brothers and says, "Please take me back home. I am very, very ill. I'm very tired. I need some sleep." They brought him back to his little home and were about to spill him over onto the bed when he says, "No, please help me onto my knees." And Livingstone buckled down on his knees by the side of his bed and clasped his hands and started to pray. His prayers were so profound, his sanctuary was so unique, that the African brothers felt it would be blasphemy to stay in this single union, communion with God. And they stepped out of his little room. And then somebody came running and said, "I need to see Mr. Livingstone for a moment." They said, "Shh, quiet please, he's praying." 5 minutes went by, they looked in, he was still on his knees. 7 minutes went by, looked in, still he was on his knees. A protracted period of time went by, they turned in, he was still on his knees. Till one of them felt the man was just too tired to continue to pray. He needed to get some sleep. They walked over towards him and one of them shook him by the shoulders and said, "Bwana, Bwana." And Livingstone fell over. He was dead. He died exactly the way he had lived. In the presence of his Lord. He didn't run from his voice. He didn't wave a lamp that had no light in it. He didn't sell his soul for some earthly pleasure. But the haunting specter of the smoke of 1,000 villages had burned itself within his heart till he could say, "My Jesus, my King, my life, my all, I again consecrate myself to thee."
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, my name is Sebastian Ritchie, and I'm a historian at the Air Historical Branch of the Royal Air Force. Some years ago, I had to start guiding staff rides, taking groups of officers around the Arnhem area, and it was that that really pricked my interest in the conflict. And it seemed to me that there was a lot more to be said about the Arnhem operation, particularly where air power was concerned. My approach was a lot broader than that. I decided that there were really three fundamental myths surrounding the operation, one of which was that the RAF and the USAF, to an extent, essentially failed the airborne forces and the ground forces. Another of which was that Market Garden was a brilliant strategic concept that was ruined by poor low-level tactical planning. And the third was that airborne operations generally can be approached just like any other operation and stand about the same sort of chance of succeeding, whereas it seemed to me, if you looked at the history of airborne operations in the Second World War, you would see very quickly that, in fact, the airborne concept was extremely problematic.
So this operation was really just about tanks, which was the garden part, and the airborne forces, the paratroopers, which was the market part. Put together, that makes Market Garden. Is that just about it?
There's much more to take into account. There is the airborne part of the operation. There is the support of the ground forces that have to be linked up with the airborne. There is the maintenance of air superiority over the battle area, keeping the Luftwaffe at bay as far as possible. There are things like radar cover, resupply for the airborne forces at their deployed locations. And obviously there is the really, really tricky task of running the airlift from a long, long way back. And one of the key problems facing the Allied Air Forces was that the transport aircraft required for the operation were all based back in the UK, some of them in the West Country, and yet they were carrying out an airborne operation some 100 miles or so into enemy-occupied territory and right up to the German frontier. And from an air perspective, that is a very, very difficult thing to do.
One of the problems was that the gliders could not go as fast as the paratroopers in their Dakotas, but they wanted to go across together. So the glider tows would have to go fairly slow, and the Dakotas could probably do 220 knots. They would have to slow right down to 100 knots, so they could only go half their speed. Is that roughly right?
Well, basically, you had to go broadly at the same sort of speed that the glider combinations fly at. That is the speed at which you are deploying, although the lifts were separate. You would have a glider lift and a parachute lift. But basically, a lot of the timing was dictated by the glider combinations, which were operating at the sort of speed that you would associate with the aircraft of the First World War. So it's the sort of performance envelope that you would associate with a First World War biplane. You know, you're talking something like 120 miles per hour on the way out there, which of course means that you've got very large, unmaneuverable aircraft, and they are flying over a large area of enemy-occupied territory. There are very significant flak deployments in Holland because Bomber Command has been flying over there night after night to get to Germany. That is a very challenging concept indeed for the Allied Air Forces.
Was it possible to do two lifts in one day? Because they said there was only going to be one lift. That would have meant if they could do two, they could get a whole division into one place on one day.
Yeah, that concept comes from the original idea behind Market Garden, which was the merger of two different operations. One of those operations was an operation called Linnet, which was to have been staged a lot closer to the UK on the French-Belgian border and involved the whole of the 1st Allied Airborne Army. The other operation was an operation called Comet, which was the first small-scale Arnhem operation, and That would have involved only first airborne division. So the idea behind Market Garden is essentially to merge the airlift for Linnet, which was two lifts on the first day, and the scale the objective of Comet. In other words, we are going to do the Linnet operation in terms of scale, but we are going to do it against Arnhem. But that means you have to fly about another 100 miles from the UK. And if you look at the timetable that they actually drew up for Operation Linnet, and you try and make that timetable work with those objectives that are significantly further from Britain, you find that it simply does not work. And this is documented. I mean, you can go back and look at what they were contemplating for Operation Linnet in the National Archives down at Kew. The records are all there. And they could just squeeze those two lifts in on day one, or so they thought, given that the objectives were that bit closer to the UK. With the objectives further afield, at Arnhem and Nijmegen, that simply made it too difficult. The lifts would take too long, the turnaround times back in the UK would take too long, and the chances of getting that second lift in were simply not worth thinking about. Also, I think another point here, if you look at the timetable, it would have required the Arnhem lift to take off a lot earlier than it did. But the records show that many of the airfields in the UK were actually closed by fog at dawn on the 17th of September 1944, and that the aircraft only took off as early as they could, which was in the sort of 9 to 10 o'clock bracket. So the possibility of doing a dawn lift in order to squeeze in a second lift on the first day of the operation was a non-starter. It simply could not have happened, and the operation would have failed at the first hurdle.
And also, there's a lot made of the bad weather. Surely you could just drop in bad weather, you could fly over there, you could navigate, and you could go in bad weather too.
No, you can't do the gliders. Basically, I mean, and even in the lift, as it happened, they lose quite a number of gliders on the first day because the tow ropes break. Basically, in foggy conditions, cloudy conditions, there was a real problem that you had with tow ropes snapping. And consequently, you cannot do it unless it's clear. I mean, the whole thing is very, very inflexible. And one of the great problems with airborne operations is the sheer number of moving parts that you have. If one thing works, then another thing works, and another thing works, and another thing works, and so on. But if just one of those things fails, potentially the whole operation can go wrong. And you see this in airborne operations in the Second World War over and over and over again. Planning and execution could be an absolute nightmare.
Also, to get a bit closer to the objective, why not take off from East Anglia? Most of these aircraft, the glider tows and the Dakotas with the paratroopers, were taking off from places like Wiltshire, many more, probably 100 miles more to the west.
And indeed it would have done. And in fact, at the beginning of September 1944, the commanding officer of 1st Allied Airborne Army, who was an American Lieutenant General called Lewis Brereton, actually wrote to Eisenhower suggesting precisely that, or indeed deploying 1st Allied Airborne Army across the Channel to bases on the continent. He was basically arguing that they were too far back and that they were now likely, we'd broken out from Normandy, we were now likely, if we were going to use airborne forces again, to use them in an operation to take bridges over the River Rhine. And for that purpose, 1st Allied Airborne Army was too far back. So what Brereton argues is, we need to go forward. Preferably, we need to go forward to the continent. But he's making that point at the beginning of September, and by the 10th of September, Market Garden is done and dusted. It's there. It's been approved. It's been rubber stamped. There's just not enough time to do it. So instead, they have to try and stage this operation from much too far back.
Wasn't one of the problems that the two main British generals, Browning, who was in charge of all three divisions, and Urquhart, who was the commanding officer of 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem, had never worked on airborne operations before? Neither of them had.
Yeah, and that is a problem as well. Urquhart had been brought in to command 1st Airborne Division from outside the airborne forces and lacked experience. Browning had much longer experience with the airborne, but in a much more administrative capacity. He'd not actually led airborne troops into battle. And yet, Browning plays a pivotal part in devising the whole market garden concept. And that really does come close to the crux of the problem, if you like. You've got an officer in a very senior, a very influential position who comes up with a plan that is problematic in almost every single way. And only somebody who lacked that experience, I think, could have produced a plan like that.
What about the failure of the tanks once Nijmegen Bridge had fallen? Why didn't the tanks just drive up to Arnhem? It was only probably 20 minutes drive away, and there was nothing to stop them.
It is. I mean, a lot of the airborne veterans have made much of that issue over the years, and I can understand the frustration that they have over that. And a lot of the writers on Market Garden have basically echoed that point. Personally, I don't think perhaps it's as important as people have made out. If you look at the enormous mountain of kit that First Airborne Division took into Arnhem with the airlift that they'd got, it's difficult to see that they were really that short of airlift. That possibly you could look at it another way and say, actually, they are bringing too much kit and possibly too many people. And even with Browning taking those gliders, if 1st Airborne Division had gone in at lighter scales in a single lift, they could have actually put two brigades into Arnhem on day one, two full brigades. The reason they can't do that is that they have a pre-planned and very inflexible airlift program, which requires them to divide manpower and equipment.
Well, you've got Browning, who is in charge of the operation. Surely, as the commanding officer, he should have gone into where the main objective was, in Arnhem. But he didn't, did he? He went to Nijmegen. It was almost as if he knew that Arnhem was going to be a disaster.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, the whole thing about him going forward, I know that people are very critical of that, but actually that was something that was, and indeed to an extent still is, ingrained in British Army doctrine. A lot of senior commanders to this day like to go forward. And I went on another of these staff rides, in fact, with the ARC headquarters a couple of years ago, and you still hear lots of arguments in favour of the senior commander going forward. But in Browning's case, I can understand why he wanted to do it. As far as not going to Arnhem is concerned, and you know, this was rather the sort of the futility, if you like, of what he did. Obviously, the idea was for him to be in touch with all three of the divisions involved in the operation as the commander of 1st Allied Airborne Army for the operation itself. I think that's the reason why he tries to essentially put himself in the middle. But the irony is that the communications don't work anyway, and he has very little success in making contact with the different divisions until some way into the operation.
So, ultimately, why do you think the operation went so wrong?
Obviously, people will argue about this one until the cows come home, but my personal view is that they took too many risks. Risks were allowed to accumulate in an uncontrolled way throughout the plan. They were just accepted. But at the same time, the Germans mobilized much more rapidly on a much larger scale than anybody really expected on the Allied side. What you tend to see in the history of Market Garden is people saying, if only they'd done that, And if only they'd done this, and if only they'd done the other thing, then everything would have been okay and the operation would have succeeded. In fact, the Germans' ability to mobilize quickly and on that scale means that that argument is fatally flawed, because it assumes that if the Allies had done something differently, the Germans would just have done the same. The fact is that because the Germans do have people in that area, because they can mobilize quickly, if the Allies had changed the way they did the operation, frankly, the Germans would simply have changed their response as well. They had that level of flexibility to do that because they have people in the area and they can respond quickly. And for that reason, I think it is very difficult indeed to devise a plausible idea of how Market Garden might have succeeded.
Why were the tanks not prepared to go to Arnhem?
They had had a very heavy fight in Nijmegen, and sometimes the scale of that fight is underestimated. I mean, Nijmegen is virtually obliterated by British shelling. We used up huge quantities of ammunition in shelling the place to try and get the Germans out of it. And the British troops who finally pitch up on the other side of the river at the end of that day are exhausted and their supplies are depleted, and they have no reliable intelligence about what is in front of them. It's a difficult one, and it is one of these old Arnhem issues that people will argue about until the cows come home. But my sense is that a push up from Nijmegen up to Arnhem at that time would probably have been problematic. The number of people who got to Arnhem might have been small. It might have made the difference, but we just don't know.
Also, didn't the Germans know through their intelligence networks they were expecting it? The whole point of an airborne operation is it's supposed to be a surprise, but didn't the Germans know we were coming?
Well, you know, I would tend to agree that issue of surprise was somewhat in question. The Germans, I think that the accurate picture is the Germans were expecting an assault towards Arnhem, but they were not expecting an airborne assault. But because they were expecting an assault towards Arnhem, they had organized their forces into these quick reaction units. And, you know, the worst thing would have been if they'd been expecting an airborne operation. The second worst thing was for them to have organized on that basis where their units in the Arnhem area could respond very quickly. And that's the situation that we were facing. But we just don't take any notice of it. I mean, there are, I know for a fact that the Allies had intercepted a German order effectively mobilizing considerable numbers of home defense troops all along the River Rhine into these quick reaction units. But we simply don't take notice of that. The prevailing view is that the Germans are defeated, or that any troops they can throw into the battle will be of low quality and will be no match for our airborne elite troops, with support of ground forces and air power and so on that we took for granted.
Your book, Arnhem Myths and Realities, is selling for around about £85 second hand. Obviously, there's a big shortage of them. Is it going to be reprinted soon?
Well, I'm hoping that it will come out as a reprint at some stage in the future, but at the moment it's too early to say.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's James Flory. I was in the infantry for a couple of years. I was in the reserve and in the regulars as well. I was never deployed. I was a peacetime soldier. My battalion was going to go to Ireland, and that's when I found out that I was a pacifist and I don't want to hurt anyone, let alone kill them. So I managed to get out.
So what about if Britain was to be attacked, or British interests were to be invaded around the world somewhere, James?
It depends what you mean by British interests. Are we talking about the people of Great Britain, everyone in Great Britain, their interests, or are you talking about the British establishment's interests and the British elite's interests? For the first part of the question, though, I don't interpret pacifism as not fighting. Everyone has the right to defend themselves. That's enshrined in the UN, and that's also enshrined in common sense and in instinct as well. So if anyone were to attack my home, if anyone were to attack my my family, I would defend them. And I would defend my home, and I would do it very aggressively.
Can you just tell us a bit about your training? What sort of, you know, how long it was for, and for you, first as a early recruit into the army, how old you were, and what's, you know, what kind of training did you get? How tough was it?
I was a bit exceptional because I joined up in my early 20s. Most recruits are teenagers. I was quite an old-fashioned recruit. There's a term, conscription by starvation, and there's another saying, there's no better recruiting sergeant than hunger. And at the time, I was homeless and jobless, and my fiancé had just dumped me, so I thought I had no choice but to join the army. It seemed reasonably attractive at the time. And so I did that. I was in the TA, and I transferred into the regulars, and I went off to train at Catterick, which is up in Yorkshire. Training was fairly rigorous, brutal in comparison, I believe, to some other armies in the world. I suppose the argument is there's a need for that because war is aggressive, war is brutal. One has to be aggressive, one has to be brutal. So for its purpose, for what the British Army is, which is an overseas expeditionary force, which kills and maims people that are weaker than they are, there is a need, there is a purpose for brutality. So training does brutalise the recruit. Because I was reasonably streetwise and relatively experienced in life, there was a lot of it that I didn't buy anyway. And I had the impression that some of the instructors kind of picked up on that, and they either resented me for it, or they kind of turned a blind eye. They sort of knew that I was a bit streetwise, if that makes sense.
What about staying with the training a bit? Are there any moments from that you really remember as being either particularly difficult or fun?
Gosh, what a big question. I remember one particular incident. I remember the brutality. I remember the violence. I remember racism as well. There was a bit of sort of casual racism towards black and minority ethnic recruits, mimicking accents, that kind of thing. I remember once I did something wrong, and we were on a march, and I was ordered to run around the squad that was marching with my weapon, my rifle, above my head, and while they were still marching, and I had to shout out, I'm an effing bender. So I remember that in particular, which was humiliating. I remember some of the guys that were weaker that dropped out, and I remember, to overcome my resentment of what I'd done, trying to help the weaker guys, if you like. And I remember feeling, I suppose, a sense of achievement when I passed out, but also a growing feeling that I'd taken the worst career choice in my life so far.
Doesn't sound like you had a lot of choice, being homeless and unemployed. I noticed recently the Daily Mirror published a story which is saying that there is something like 1,800, possibly more, right this minute, army veterans homeless on the streets of Britain.
Yeah, I can well believe it. I've just emerged from 2 years in a veterans hostel. because I was homeless for a short time. And there's one military charity that I know that I've experienced called Veterans Aid. They're a fantastic charity. They're fairly neutral. All they want to do is help down and out veterans, of which there are a lot of. You just have to walk around the streets of any city or town in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales to come across veterans. There's a lot of guys that have served that are out on the streets, and I met a lot of them in the hostel in Stepney, New Belvedere House. And it's fairly obvious that when guys join up when they're kids, when they're lads, and they go through a process and they're dehumanized and they get deployed to various places and then they come out, a lot of them can't cope. A lot of them can't readjust to what they call civilian life. And it's very confusing. It's confusing for most adults, particularly now in 2018.
Now, it's a difficult jobs market out there. Does the Army do anything to help you get your first foot on the ladder in Civvy Street?
Not really, no. No, I think once they've got the best out of you, you're kind of chewed up and spat out, if you like. It's not the whole case. There's some people that do very well out of it and some people that benefit from their service and some people that get some help, but there's a lot of guys that don't as well. So I don't know what the statistics are, but they're quite high. They're too high. Anyone that ends up on the street is too much, in my opinion. Not just if you've been in the forces, but if you're a human being, we all as human beings deserve food, shelter, love. And guys that have been in the Army, in the Navy, in the Air Force, sometimes that's lacking. And they come unstuck.
Now, we're coming up to the end of the First World War, the anniversary of it, the 100th anniversary. The idea of wearing a red poppy to commemorate those who died, really, to say that they didn't die for nothing, and so we remember them. Do you wear a red poppy?
I used to. Up until a few years ago, I used to wear a red poppy. Ever since I was a child, my father was involved. His family were involved in the war in Burma. He lived in Burma, and he joined the Indian Army, and went off to fight in the jungle. And he used to drag me along to Remembrance Day services or parades, if you like, in our little part of London. He never wore a poppy, he never had medals, he never spoke about it. I only found out after he died 20 years ago that he had this military service. I knew other guys, as we've all known, guys that have been in the Second World War in particular. I met and interviewed 20-odd years ago veterans of the First World War. I was lucky enough to meet and spend time with veterans of the First World War. Not many of them wore poppies. And one could argue that they had that right because they were there, in inverted commas. And I also remember in the 1990s, the early 1990s, there wasn't so much interest in wearing poppies. Even in the 1980s, growing up, there wasn't that much interest. People did or people didn't. But there wasn't an uproar as there is now.
Do you remember why the First World War veterans said, did they tell you why they didn't wear a poppy?
But they were reasonably indifferent to it. I think it was a kind of matter of petty symbolism. Really didn't matter to them. What mattered to them is that everyone got along well and people didn't fight because they'd seen the worst of fighting. So symbols, little symbols like red poppies, white poppies, black poppies, sky blue, pink poppies, didn't really matter to them. What mattered to them was peace.
And I know up until about 10 years ago, even just on their website, the British Legion, who steward the poppy campaign, they actually had a little thing on there in their magazine, on their website, saying that we couldn't put an end to war, which is a fairly challenging thing to say, even though they don't say it anymore. Anyway, what do you make of the way the Legion and the Red Poppy campaign is going?
The Legion is a really interesting case in point. A cynic might say that the British Legion was set up in the early 1920s with the purpose of diverting or distracting or making veterans' lives slightly more comfortable, in that in every town, every village, every district, every borough had a British Legion club. And what's every British Legion club got in it? A bar. And what has that bar got? It's got cheap drink, it's got cheap alcohol. Most of the veterans that came back in 1918-1919, they had experienced something that previous generations had never experienced before. They'd got together. They got together with junior officers as well. They were pretty literate. They were pretty world-wise. They understood what the establishment was about, what it was like. Ideas were spreading, and there was resentment. There was resentment about how the establishment were treating them. There was resentment about lies that Lloyd George peddled about homes fit for heroes. These guys were organised. They managed to organise themselves. They got together. They were seen as dangerous by the establishment. So the establishment, I'll use that word again cynically, set up the British Legion to ply these men with cheap alcohol. One of the oldest tricks in the book.
But surely, the Legion were also giving all sorts of relief to these veterans who come back after the First World War and lost everything. Some of them, at least, maybe help them get them back on their feet again.
Well, up to a point, it's not the whole story, because a lot of the veterans had to form their own associations. Let's take the old contemptibles, the regular soldiers, the professionals that went out there in 1914. They formed the old contemptibles association. And a lot of these guys, you can read it in the archives and in old newspapers and in memoirs, a lot of these guys fell on really hard times. And there was no welfare state. There was no NHS for them. So they were sort of lifted out of dire, appalling poverty by the comrades or regimental associations. It wasn't just the Legion. The Legion has done much, but it hasn't done enough, sadly, tragically. And it's interesting to look at how much their directors are paid as well, and also how much their budget is for PR and advertising. And that's not just today in 2018. That could go back right down the decades.
What about the different types of war? First World War, many people see that, I think quite rightly, as questionable point to it, really. I mean, Britain wasn't directly threatened itself. Millions of young men gave their lives to so-called defend Britain, but Britain wasn't actually under attack. And then the Second World War, which maybe there was a bit more point to, with the spread of fascism, the Nazis occupying almost all of Europe. And then since then, we've seen very different sorts of war. You mentioned Burma, then there's also Korea, Malaya, and then the more modern wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, that sort of thing. What do you think about the way that, I mean, effectively now what's happening with the poppy and the British Legion, the poppy appeal, is that they're all kind of lumped in together as one?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Like you said, there's been two world wars in the last 100 years. For whatever reason, to fight militarism, fascism, Nazism, and then around that and in between that, there's been what historians or commentators or experts might call imperial wars or colonial wars. And that goes back to this term of in inverted commas British interests, and whose interests are they really? Is it serving the elite? Is it serving the people? Is it serving the people that have been colonised, etc., etc.? There's all these questions that haven't really been addressed by the establishment that tells us to in inverted commas remember. So we've got this kind of stark difference, as you pointed out, for different conflicts and wars and fighting in the last 100 years. And why aren't we remembering the dead of the Boer War? They're never mentioned. That was in the 20th century. Why aren't we remembering the dead of the, I don't know, the expedition into Tibet, the military expedition into there? That was in the 20th century as well. Why aren't we remembering some of these more obscure imperial adventures? And why are we turning colonial wars, post-colonial wars, into something, a thing of beauty, a thing of glory that saves everyone's lives, that saves the British way of life? life when they're not really. It doesn't take that much scratching beneath the surface to see what they're really about, and what they're really about is keeping rich people very rich.
The Daily Telegraph published an article this year, White Poppy Sales Soar as an MP criticises this disingenuous trend. Sales of controversial white poppies have soared, new figures reveal, as an MP has criticised the disingenuous trend for appropriating the traditional poppy symbol. The Peace Pledge Union, who make and produce the white poppy, have seen a 30% increase in the number being sold compared to this time last year. And the Conservative MP and former British Army officer Johnny Mercer last week described the poppies as attention-seeking rubbish.
Right. That's interesting, coming from a politician who... Politicians like a bit of attention, don't they? And the fact that he's come out and said that might be seen as attention-seeking. Like I was saying earlier, a poppy is a poppy is a poppy. It's a symbol. It's a little symbol as well. If someone wants to wear a white poppy, they can wear a white poppy. If someone wants to wear a red poppy, they can wear a red poppy. If someone wants to wear a purple poppy, I think they're to remember animals that died, they can do that. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what colour poppy you wear. What matters is peace, and what matters is getting along.
Well, one of the other things he says, James, is every soldier I know wants peace.
Yeah, well, of course they do. Of course, everyone wants peace.
Come there's wars then? I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense. It must be some of the soldiers that actually want to fight. Otherwise, you wouldn't get any wars.
Soldiers don't really have that choice. If you take my experience of being a soldier very briefly, I didn't join because I wanted a war, and the kids that are recruited know nothing about war either. They're conditioned to think that. No one wants war. Anyone that's experienced war doesn't want war, apart from if you're a kind of madman like Adolf Hitler or Mussolini or whatever, or Churchill even. Soldiers don't want war. No service people want war. No one wants war.
The only thing is that actually some people do make a lot of money out of it, don't they? Particularly the arms companies and those who want to grab resources.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. There's that side of it as well. There's, you know, war is big business, and it always has been. That's isn't it? It's, you know, it's driven. Wars are always driven or persecuted, prosecuted, whatever, by people that don't get involved in them, and by people that can do very well out of them.
So, James, just to sum up, you know, if someone is saying to you, why aren't you wearing your red poppy? What would you say?
I would say I don't need to wear a red poppy. I don't need to wear a red poppy. What I need to do is get along with people and raise awareness of the cost of war and keep on peddling the message that war is not the answer to the problems that we face in the 21st century. And a red poppy or a white poppy isn't going to do anything, really. It's just a symbol.
So I know it's a big question, but what is the answer?
Would I know? If I knew that, then I wouldn't be sitting here, you know.
Well, you'd probably better raise an army to fight for it if you knew what it was.
Perhaps I would, Tony. Perhaps I would. If I knew the answer, I would be in the UN in New York or wherever. I wouldn't be in this sort of dingy flat in West London. Would that I knew the answer. We do know the answer collectively because we're a sophisticated generation. We've learnt much. We have much information out there. We have much experience to learn from. We can apply this. We can do this. We can get together. We can try and stop war tomorrow. We can't. I'm not saying we can stop war, but we can try, and that's something that humans need to put their attention to. Not starting wars and not carrying on wars, but stopping wars, because it's the worst thing that humanity can do. It's a failure in humanity, and it really is the very worst thing. It's not just glorified Call of Duty bayonet fighting or whatever. It's utterly miserable. You know, most people that die in wars in these days and since the Second World War are civilians. So we're talking about men, women, children, babies, and they don't have quick deaths either. They suffer terribly, and some people take years to die. And it's smelly, and it's dirty, and it's humiliating. And that's what war is. And we can stop it collectively as humans because we're better than that.
I was quite surprised to find there's this organisation called Veterans for Peace. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, Veterans for Peace, it's a voluntary organisation. It started off in the United States from a collection of Vietnam veterans. It's an international organisation now. The UK branch has a good few hundred members from all branches of the armed forces. And it covers the world, basically. And its slogan, its statement is war is not the solution to the problems that we face in the 21st century. And it's a very active movement, and it's open to everyone. Anyone that's served is welcome to join. It's apolitical. It's not it's not anti-British. It's not anti-establishment. It's not left wing or right wing. It's just veterans who feel that there is an alternative to war and that we must work towards that alternative.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like, online at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Ravi Zacharias, talking about Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Also, Sebastian Ritchie, author of Arnhem, Myths and Realities, the Chief Historian of the Royal Air Force. And James Florey, for Veterans for Peace, talking about the Poppy Appeal. And two studio engineers, Dave Bazenko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. Volunteer with us if you like, offer hundreds of opportunities across Britain, if you've got the time, that is, via the National Volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, Inshallah, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
so